are listening to the Fundamentalist Podcast.
Until the light takes us, am I right, Bog?
Oui.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back into the Fundamentalists Podcast. I'm your host, dual guest, joined as always by Richard Donahue.
Hello.
And Peter Bog.
What's up, everybody?
On this episode of the podcast, we are returning to Under the Knife Slayer, this time for part two. Thank you for listening to part one. And for those of you who are intimately aware of Slayer's catalog, which almost every metalhead is, let's be honest, you know there's really not a whole lot of deviation of opinion when it comes to those first 10 years of Slayer. It fucking rules. You might have gleaned that we shared the same opinion, not only from what we said, but from our top 10 list. Very, very similar. I think we're not really treading any new ground or breaking any news when we say that Slayer fucking ruled in the 1980s. You cannot say the same for what we are about to talk about now. There's definitely some differing opinion when it comes to the quality of these next seven Slayer records. However, one thing is for sure is that we are hitting some fucking valleys and not nearly as many peaks. But that makes for some really funny opinions, and it's fun to sling some shit every now and then. So bust out your umbrella because the shit grenades are about to start flying. Welcome into Under the Knife Slayer Part 2, presented by the Fundamentalist Podcast. I will turn it back over to the leader of this Under the Knife, Richard Donahue. Take it away, sir.
Pick you up from where we left off. Lombardo is now out of the band due to issues of, wanting to take time off the band touring more and more. So in his place to take the drum throne, they got Paul Bostoff, who of X-Forbidden. His playing was a bit more technical than the more primalness of Lombardo, but made some more interesting dynamics musically.
I was going to say, let's reserve the quality judgments here as we proceed.
Bringing the highlights, his approach was a bit more technical compared to Lombardo's. So just drumming wise, specifically, that's it.
I don't know if I agree with that. More technical than Dave Lombardo? All right, well, we're really jumping right into the fire, aren't we? So let's go.
All right, so they rehearsed for a month or two, and then they went into multiple studios, not just one, for Divine Intervention, because according to Carey, they would book the band a week here, a week there, a week here, 2 weeks here, for some whatever reason. And I believe that ultimately led to the very poor mixing and mastering of 1994's Divine Intervention.
I was going to agree. You can definitely fucking tell that it was not a cohesive process because there are some drastic changes in guitar tone from even in the same song, especially from track to track. There's some disjointed nonsense on this record.
Very much so. Though surprisingly so, not to jump ahead, this was still the top-selling, first week Slayer record of all time. It's like moving 93,000 units its first week, and the first Slayer record to reach top 10, along with the Lion King soundtrack, Boys to Men, and Phil fucking Collins. But more to the music. The mix.
I was going to say, speaking of Divine Intervention.
The mixing and mastering production was so tumultuous that they had to call Rick Rubin at the 11th hour to kind of save the recording. And even then, it doesn't do much, I hate to say, because you have cranked this bad boy up many a time, and it's still barely above a whisper.
What was Rick Rubin doing at this time? Outside of Slayer.
94. I don't know.
Red Hot Chili Peppers?
Maybe.
Actually, Blood Sugar Sex Magik was, I think, 93, 94. So, yeah. Something along those lines, probably hip-hop and pop shit as well.
It's sort of ironic that he didn't get give this more attention, because I have to remember back that Pantera's Far Beyond Driven was number one in 94. So metal was arguably in sort of its commercial heyday in many ways.
At least when it comes to the heavier end of the spectrum, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. We're not talking about cherry pie.
No, not at all. So what are some of y'all's thoughts on this record? I'm personally, well, I mean, I'm biased as fuck. It's one of my favorite Slayer albums, actually, even with the kind of crap production on it.
It's essentially the last gasp of Tom Araya's voice as far as like the peak. Like, it starts to gradually go downhill, and it's a real shame. We'll get to it in a minute. It's a real shame that some of the best years left, theoretically, were taken up by Undisputed Attitude and Diabolus and Musica, because what the fuck? But we're going to stick with Divine Intervention for right now. And if you ignore some of the disjointed songs, the kind of the inconsistency of the mixing and the mastering, which has already been mentioned, there's some cool Slayer on here. And you can definitely tell this is made in the years following Seasons in the Abyss, because some of the songs have a lot of that same Seasons vibe. However, as much as that is a compliment, it is also a bit of an insult too, because these are all definitely the B-sides on Seasons in the Abyss. I'm struggling to think of one song on this record that you could even make an argument deserves that would deserve to be on that record, even if it sounds like they were written around the same time.
Yeah, I mean, 4 years later, too, I think I would have hoped there was a little bit more progress here. Basically, this just does sound like a muddier version of Seasons in many ways to me. Duel, you had, you know, sort of said that early on, and I found myself by and large agreeing with it. There are a few moments I want to call out, sort of the jangly clean part on the title track that sounds a little bit Alice in Chains-ish to me, and so I think that they definitely were absorbing some... some of the influence in what was happening commercially, as I mentioned before, and we're definitely going to see a lot more of that very shortly on the next album. But overall, it seems a little bit unfocused. You know, it felt like they knew what they were doing on Seasons, and then this is the first time where potentially they, you know, came back and they had seen how much the musical environment around them had changed, and they just kind of, you know, put this one out there to, in many ways, sort of test the waters still, it felt like. Which is
maybe aside from...
I was just going to say, which is potentially why maybe they didn't put up more of a fuss when they were, you know, recording it, like you said, in a little bit of a unorthodox and haphazard way compared to the way that they had done previously, considering how much acclaim Slayer had at this point in their career.
Richard, was there a reason why they did this? Like, I know Pantera does it later on in the 90s with the Great Southern Trendkill, but that's because of drugs and a falling out between band members. There was at least like a interpersonal reason. Like, I'm not sure why one would make the conscious choice to work in such a non-cohesive manner.
According to Carrie, it was the studio. Like, they really had no desire to do it, but the label was booking it, was paying all the covering all their overhead costs, and the label was like, you're here, then here, then here, then here, and they just kind of went along for the ride, though. Apparently, they did do a lot more writing outside the studio than previous albums, because they had three of these songs written before going in the studio, which is kind of unusual for Slayer.
Well, depending on which songs they are, that could be a good thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think there's a couple of great ones on here. Dittohead, I'm personally a big fan, very hardcore punk influenced. The title track, Divine Intervention. My personal favorite, probably might be the best, the whole record, 213. Which is about Jeffrey Dahmer. I think Head Shoulders is the best song off the entire record. And Sex, Murder, Art, and Serenity and Murder is a bit more melodic, kind of clean-ish singing. Maybe it's a somewhat throwback to South.
Hold that thought on Sex, Murder, Art. Bog, you were going to say something?
Richard, am I remembering correctly that this was the record where Tom said this was the last time they had a sit down with the label and they talked about wanting kind of a single, you know, sort of that cliched conversation.
Yes.
And he said that, you know, that didn't exactly go well. And so I had wondered a little bit if maybe this studio situation was the label sort of leaning on Slayer or kind of twisting the knife on them in some ways because they weren't willing to be more receptive to, you know, getting them that single. I suppose that's purely speculation, but it's kind of a curious curious sequence of events that led to diminished quality on this record overall.
Highly likely it's gonna be a punishment. It's like, okay, fuck you, all right, fuck you, we'll show you what's up. And maybe this is a little cat mouse game.
Well, I'm sure what the label was looking at was, as you had already mentioned, Bog, I don't know if it came out right before or right after, but Far Beyond Driven is either already or is about to become the first number one real heavy metal record. And say like shit on it all you want to, but Load sold like a motherfucker. Megadeth in the last 2 years had put, or 4 years had put out Rest in Peace, Countdown to Extinction, and Euthanasia, all which sold really fucking well on the back of some really fucking popular singles. I don't remember what Anthrax was doing at this time. So I imagine I imagine the label is like, what the fuck? Why can't you get on board? Because they're seeing these other bands of their ilk selling like gangbusters. And when they have, you have a name like Slayer, I guess they would assume that they should be selling the same. But I believe Slayer's sales numbers have consistently been some of the lowest of the big four, just by nature of their subject matter, I guess you could say.
It's weird when you talk about the big four's name. It's not something that I ever really thought that much about. But if you talk about purely sort of the violence of the big four's name, Slayer is probably at the highest, then Megadeth. Anthrax is still a chemical, right, that causes death. Metallica is the only one that sounds like they could potentially be a glam band or something, right?
But the label doesn't give a fuck when you're selling God knows how many millions of albums. I mean, if the Black Album is still on the fucking Billboard charts to this day, I mean, what was it still doing when Load was out? It was probably up there in the top 10 along with Load. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Oy, oy, oy. I'll agree that I think, you know, Ditto Head is an interesting track because it's sort of one of the first times that I saw really overt, like, political justice criticisms. I was a little bit disappointed that SS3 wasn't a more interesting track, because when I saw, you know, reading about this, that they were going back to some kind of like, you know, Nazi, you know,
it's about
themes.
Reinhard Heydrich.
But it's about him being stalked. Yeah, stalked and actually killed. I think that SS3 isn't the license plate number in which he was sort of sniped inside of. So it certainly isn't the same Joseph Mengele, you know, Angel of Death kind of themes that we saw earlier. It's actually a very different take on it. And I don't know if that was, you know, because they just aren't as emboldened anymore to continue that, or, you know, who knows the reasons why, but it's a very different take on a similar subject matter. And I think that that's kind of, I don't know, symbolic of the shift that we're seeing in this band as well. It definitely started on Seasons when, you know, the references to Satan certainly shrank to just sort of an absolute minimum. And Circle of Beliefs is another track on here where there is some more, you know, criticism of Christianity, but it's not using Satan as sort of the antithesis of it. It's actually talking about sort of the ways inside of Christianity. You know, a lyric here I said is mentally so small you can't accept the other side. I'm gonna cut it after that. But
I also wanted to take it back to Seasons in the Abyss to make this comparison. Dead Skin Mask is one of the most popular tracks off Seasons in the Abyss, and for good reason. And it was one of the first times since one of the most effective times, not one of the first times, one of the most effective times that Slayer had really slowed it down. And, you know, for a band that's known for playing at breakneck speed, it was really like, you know, a hard hitting thing that something like Dead Skin Mask can hit just as hard as something like Angel of Death. And I feel like Slayer really tried to almost noticeably copy themselves with 213, another slow mid-tempo plotting song about another serial killer. And this theme of essentially recycling a song idea is going to continue, and it gets worse, much, much worse. Also about atrocities from World War II, that theme will also continue later with Unit 731. I think there's a few other ones as well. Yeah. We'll get to that. I also teased a comment on sex, murder, art. This is also when Slayer starts to get fucking cringy. And I know that we say some cringy shit on this podcast, but holy shit. I don't think we can touch the levels of just bad that is available on these next seven records. Richard is unfolding the lyric sheet, and man, this isn't even where we should start, because there's some decent stuff, both decent songs and even some decent lines on this record that are still acceptable. Like I said, Seasons in the Abyss B-sides, and 213 is good. In the Name of God is good. Moving on.
Sex, murder, art is not forgettable. Whether or not it's good or celebrated is another question.
One more fun fact before you get off this record. The title track, actually, everyone in the band, Araya, King, Hahnemann, and Paul Bosso contributed lyrically. It's the only song that I've seen out of this era that everyone contributed lyrically to the song. But I just want to add to that.
Those goddamn Heinekens.
And also, this was finally the birth of bald Kerry King on this record too. Let us not forget.
He didn't have the tattoos yet, though. It's an important distinction that those came later.
Yes, but he would just, he finally came baldy. And, all right.
Well, not to paint a satanic band with a biblical brush, but holy shit, it all makes sense. He cut his hair like Samson and it just don't need it.
So, band either touring for Divine Intervention and whatnot. All right. Following Divine Intervention, I guess they had a contractual obligation to put out another album. So they put out 1996's Undisputed Attitude, which is...
This is one they wanted to get away from American Records, yeah.
So that sounds about right. So they put this album out. It's essentially a collection of hardcore punk songs, which are all right. Doesn't do much for me personally, though. The only slightly interesting thing is, I believe it's tracks 4 and 5, Can't Stand You and Damn, were an old Jeff Hanneman project called Pap Smear, which featured Rocky from Suicidal Tendencies. So I would say that's pretty much the only interesting thing on this record. And the final track, Gemini, is a Slayer original. Everything else covers of old punk hardcore bands.
Okay, so there's a lot of things you could say about this record. One, it was a bad idea that I feel strongly should have been fucking prevented. Unfortunately, no one else in the band thought so. Secondly, Slayer is really fucking lucky they have two people of Latin descent in this band. Otherwise, they would look at them covering the song Guilty of Being White and some of their other songs with a much more stringent eye, let me say. Other than that, the most interesting thing about this record is that the originals exist. However, I'm significantly less interested in each one of those originals knowing that Slayer did this to all of them. And that's all I'll ever fucking think of. This record is boring as fuck, should not exist, and that's about as nice as I can be about it. Bog, do you have something to say?
Yeah, my first note here is I said I don't know why this exists, especially since these covers are so faithful. In some ways, I kind of think this is the best Tom's vocals have sounded in three records on all these covers, because he's kind of, you know, that sort of monotone shouting is actually, you know, potentially derived from their punk rock roots. And, you know, I like, you know, these Minor Threat covers on here. They're fun. The reason I think that this exists is because they were testing the waters with that final track, Gemini, which is really a little bit of a microcosm of what we're going to see on the next record. And I think that they kind of slid that one out there to see how much people were going to try and revolt, buried underneath like a lot of angst. And that's kind of firmly why I believe that this is here.
A microcosm of the things we're going to get on the next record. It's like the fecal matter left over in the toilet after you flush as a preview for what's about to come.
Yeah, that's another way to put it.
That's a more crude way of putting it, sir. But
one might say accurate.
There's anyway. A song here called Richard Hung Himself. I don't know if you saw that, Mr. Craig Life.
I did see that. Richard Hung Himself, yes. It's all right.
Foreshadowing.
When we do the final episode of the pod, I'm ended on a high note, literally and figuratively speaking. So,
It is curious, though. I really do wonder if they did this record because they weren't quite ready to, I guess, take the plunge. You know, like, were they still trying to resist the eventual musical change, which we're about to talk about? You know, this feels like sort of a death rattle in some ways.
I mean, I don't buy that considering the success of Pantera. They went heavier. They fucking rebelled. It was like, no, fuck that. Like, the Great Southern Trendkill is a brutally heavy record. Like, yes. Saw mainstream success. And I think it came out in the exact same year as Diabolus.
96, yes, same year.
So, Diabolus came out in 98, 2 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know what Carrie's talking about when he was like, we really had no choice. You know, we just had to go with the flow. Clearly, you don't.
Well, they were in Southern California. It's curious to think about the environment that they were in, and that maybe, you know, the commercial pressure, again, that being, you know, they're, you know, we talked earlier on in part one about how they were earlier reared in a, you know, sort of more Huntington Beach, Orange County environment. But by this point, I'm sure that most of them are living in Pasadena or fucking Hollywood or something. And that's where they were.
Lars Ulrich had joined Slayer in 98.
I don't know. I hear you, Duel, but I also don't think that everybody, you know, had the privilege of sort of blazing their own trail like Pantera did. And that's part of the reason why they were so influential. I mean, you know, we look at Pantera and say that they in many ways were the reason that, you know, Rob Halford decided to leave Judas Priest, you know, to go and try and pursue a band that sounded a lot like them. So they certainly shook up the music scene. Not everybody was privileged to do what they do.
We have spoken on this podcast, Bog, that I do think that Pantera is partially responsible for the popularity of nu metal, some of that, some of Dimebag's riffing. So while they may be responsible for spawning it, they at least spent most of their career atoning for that mistake. Do you think they ever forgave themselves knowing that they're partially responsible for what happened to Slayer? Given what a huge fan they are of them. My hero followed me off a fucking cliff that I didn't go down myself.
Son of a bitch.
It's a generational divide, man. Slayer's eyes were getting clouded over with the cataracts at that point, while, you know, young Dime and Phil were still out drinking liquor straight from the bottle. So that was fucked up of me to say, by the way.
Funny. But, in late 1996, Paul Bostoff left the band to pursue some side projects no one gave a fuck about. So they originally tapped Gene Hoagland to replace Bostoff, but he was just finishing a tour with Death. So this guy named John Deep, who's filled in for everyone, their mom, and Thrasty, kept hounding Slayer. And
no, like, I was just thinking, what a fucking bullet dodge by Gene Hoagland. Do you think he was just being professional, like, sorry, I just got off tour? Or he, like, heard some of these songs being written and was like, what the fuck is this? You just got finished playing, like, Terminal Spirit Disease.
Right.
And
that's what
you're getting
thinking.
Shit from, you're getting Love to Hate. They're like, it kicks, right? But I was like, I just got off tour, man. Not for me.
But John Deep essentially kept harassing the band, so they eventually chose John Deep over Togo, as you said. Togo definitely dodged a bullet on that one. Until 97, they had some he had some falling out with some of the members. It's kind of vague. And then they brought Bostoff back into the fold. Enter the year. No, sir. Opening scene, 1998. Korn, Deftones, and Limp Bizkit are topping the charts. Slayer is at a musical fork in the road. They either stick to their guns or join in the trend. And like a bear on meth, it wasn't a good idea. But they went with the trend. And that unfortunate result of this unholy abomination was Diabolus in Musica.
So, you know how after the 4th of July shooting, the kids' parents were like, we never saw anything coming. We never saw this coming. There were no warning signs. And then we found out over this last week that there was about 1.5 million warning signs. This is kind of what I feel about this record. The entirety of the 90s had been leading up to this. They had been flirting with it. That track Gemini that Bog mentioned was essentially their manifesto being written. Like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to fucking do it. And then they fucking did it. And by God, did they do it. A lesser band would have murdered their career with this record alone. This is like 3 Hollywood flops and a rape charge all at once. For like the Ezra Miller of Slayer's career.
I will say that whenever they change the logo, it's a bad sign. It's a bad sign.
Typically, yes. Unless you're dying fetus.
Or immolation. You can change and make sort of to make good music, but yeah. So I will give Diabolus a few things, surprisingly. I think the production is really good and fucking massive. Like, the drums sound really good. It's heavy as fuck. Tom's vocals sound really good, actually. The problem is there's a horrible filter and it's just about every fucking song, and the songs are incredibly unmemorable. So, you know, it's still shit. It's still a pig. If you put lipstick and makeup on it, it's still a fucking pig. And that's like a good reference for this album.
It's like if Disturbed wrote a parody of a Slayer album, this is what it would sound like, but it's actually fucking Slayer. Like, the bounciness is obscene for a band that used to just be like, let's just fucking snap their necks with the ferocity of our playing. So now, like, let's just play fucking
Death's Head.
It's like, let's just make them jump out their JNCOs for 45 minutes. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. I wish I could say something nicer about it. I like In the Name of God.
Yes.
That's really the best. Yeah.
By a long way.
Even their, like, cringy, you'd figure with, like, the cover art, they'd at least have something interesting to say, even if they didn't pair it with good music, but even that is non-existent.
Yeah, it's, you know, there are some interesting components on this, because again, this is still Slayer, and they're, you know, seasoned songwriters. I would say generally the compositions on most of these tracks are varied and somewhat interesting. It was way more listenable than I remember it being the first time around, but unfortunately, sort of the try-hardness of the tracks that are on here are just, you know, you can't overlook them. I've sort of debated in the Slack channel whether or not I thought Stain of the Mind or Love to Hate was the absolute low point for this band, because Stain of the Mind is straight corn and Love to Hate is just Limp Bizkit, you know? I mean, it's just like, come on, guys, like, we're so much better than this, you know?
And they're both like terrible song titles. Like Stain of Mind is like, you kind of already know what you're going to get. And then Love to Hate, like, I mean, if that doesn't perfectly sum up what the worst of Slayer is at this point in time, I don't know what else does.
Yeah.
Until you get to the end of God Hates Us All. That's the other thing. They say that this was an accident. We really didn't know what else to do. Yada, 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 yada. 3 years later in 2001, they try to make it happen again at the end of God Hates Us All. They trick you into thinking, all right, Slayer's back for four fucking songs. And by the time Here Comes the Pain happens, you're wondering to yourself, then what the fuck was the last 15 years, dude? The pain's been here for a long time.
I can see Slayer struggling internally on this album as well, because, you know, the latter half of Bitter Peace sounds like a Slayer song. You know, Scrum is almost a Slayer song. You know, there are the fast moments here where they do become the band that they have been previously, but the production, the tone, you know, Tom's vocals are, you know, filtered in such a way, as was alluded to earlier, that it's so very period, and it's just, I don't know, disappointing to see that they finally went down this road for real. And I, you know, I know that they have sort of looked back, and I think Carrie said that this was their Turbo, referencing the disco album that Judas Priest put out, you know, which is a very cute way to try and say that, you know, that this album sucked, and that,
guys,
you know, it's so funny that, you know, this feels so much more devastating than any Machine Head album. I mean, we constantly talk about how Rob Flynn, you know, never found a trend in metal that he wasn't willing to jump right on top of, you know.
God,
and yet, in many ways, those feel more successful because that was their identity. This, to me, feels like a real crime. You know, in part, I think Duel said, because, you know, you look back and you say we could have seen this coming. And I said that I think that we definitely saw it on Gemini. And in part, that's why I think the previous record existed in the first place. But, you know, I really wonder, you know, how did the band feel about themselves? And also, like, you know, what did they think the future for themselves are going to be at this point?
I think it was a purely business decision. I mean, they had to see what was selling at the time, and maybe they did feel powerless against it. But, you know, you as an artist, you don't have to necessarily do that. I know that, you know, if it's your daily living, you're not going to intentionally flush your career down the toilet. But can we be honest with ourselves and admit that, hey, these guys aren't going to be fucking scraping the ground for peanuts if they had put out a traditional Slayer record in 1998 instead of the Abolition Musica? Maybe it wouldn't have opened up top five, top 10, but where did Diabolus even end up? I don't think it tore up the charts either way. The only thing it tore up was their reputation.
It was disappointing to hear that they played Stain of the Mind for much of the, you know, future as well. Like, that was in constant rotation, which it was a fucking shock, considering of the two tracks that I cited as the low point, that was one of them, and that was what they decided to keep in rotation. Like, play Perversions of Pain. God. You know, there are some redeemable qualities about that song. Yeah, like, come on.
In the Name of God. There was ways that they could have more convincingly made me believe that they were sorry for this record. But this, and the fact that they essentially tried to backdoor it to you on God Hates Us All, makes me think that they weren't sorry, and they were just sad it didn't sell as well the first time around.
We talked about the band's changing style a little bit too, from, you know, what was early, you know, thrash metal, you know, lots of acid wash jackets. They all had long hair. Kerry shaved his head. I think it was around this time that he got the massive tribal tattoos, which I, you know, was certainly the Kerry King that I grew up knowing. And I think are pretty lame overall, generally speaking. You know, so the band's image was shifting. I posted one in the Slack channel of all of them wearing a lot of droopy tank tops, and I joked to say that it was actually the lineup for WWE SmackDown. So they certainly weren't the Slayer of yesteryear. I think that they were experimenting with all facets of their lives and their image, and pretty much everything was on the table at this point.
I mean, there's no reason why you have to look the same way when you're 40 as you did when you were 18. I mean, I understand wanting to change your image. It's funny that you talked about the tribal tattoos and everything. I remember the first time I ever saw Kerry King was in that video for Sum 41's What We're All About. That was on the Spider-Man soundtrack. I'd heard Slayer, but I don't remember it ever seeing any of them. And I didn't even know who it was until years later when I started listening to Slayer. I'm like, it all makes sense now. And ironically enough, that's like the most coherent guitar solo I think that he ever wrote, which makes me think it's the dude from Sum 41 fucking wrote, because it sounds like a pop punk solo.
It's like 10 seconds long. That's probably why it's coherent, is he could barely get a few notes out before they went back to the chorus, right?
Yeah, that's probably true. That's also probably true. Donahue, do you have anything else to say about Diabolus and Musica? Because
not really. I think Perverted Pain's a good song. Bitter Peace, the most part's a good song, but everything else struck as fucking garbage. 100%.
Yes, but best left on the scrap heap of history when it comes to this band. Like, I feel like everybody gets one, at least, if you, depending on the level of success you had. Metallica has Saint Anger, Megadeth has Risk. This is 100% Slayer's, but there are some honorable mentions in that regard, too.
From the shithole that is Diabolus and Musica, their next album, God Hates Us All, came out on September 11, 2001, which is a day of infamy still in this country, and Phil would never really recovered from it in a lot of ways. But this album, I would say, definitely is angry as fuck and fun in a fun-esque.
In hindsight, 20 years later, I would argue the lyrics on this record are an equal tragedy to the other events that took place on 9/11. Have you read the lyrics to Payback?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
You got to drink every time he says fuck or fucking or fucker or some, and you have to multiply it as well. If he says two of them in the same sentence, you have to take the shots squared.
Personally, I can't see
you'd
why
die.
Tom at one point was like, hey, Carrie, why don't you tone down the cursing? Be a little more coherent,
no.
A little more interesting. But
did you see?
Just like,
I'm sorry to arrest this,
no,
but I mean,
ahead.
When they went to the new studio, so this one was the first one not produced by Rick Rubin since Rain and Blood, right?
They
also recorded this one in Canada because I think were they on a different label at this point, and that was where they could get cheaper studio time, was in Vancouver rather than Los Angeles. So
yeah, it was something along those lines. Yeah.
So when they went up to, you know, good old Canada and set up their studio environment, they said they got, you know, like what, skulls and devil masks and put them on the amps, and they taped porn up on the walls and like lit candles. And that's like where they wrote this record. And I mean, to me, that just sounds just so lame. Like, just so lame.
Like, the parody of themselves is like cringy.
But that's,
I feel like,
right.
Like, if you at least go by their promo material in the 80s when they were putting out classic shit, it just looked like they were dudes in leather jackets smashing beers, eating pizza, and singing about Satan. And now it seems like they're trying hard to be Slayer. Like, everyone associates Slayer as like this tough, evil band, and so they have to like match this image when I feel like they were just themselves previously. And the 12-year-old angsty diary masquerading as tough guy lyrical approach that existed on this record and on the one before, just, it doesn't work. And it, years later, it's even worse. I can't imagine anyone ever like hearing that and being like, yeah, that guy's hard.
I will say this album always fools you at first, because the opening three songs, not kind of the intro, Disciple, God's Death, the New Faith, they're all kick-ass songs. Like, fuck, this is
yeah.
Slayer's back, guys.
Absolutely.
And then it's like, ugh. Now, I will say I do enjoy the song Seven Faces quite a bit, and Bloodline is an awesome song, minus that shitty fucking guitar solo, possibly one of Carrie's worst guitar solos ever on Bloodlines.
I do also like Seven Faces, but another thing that this record does that Bog made or mentioned previously, I don't think it was on the air, so I'll turn it to him so he can explain it better, but that even when Slayer gets on the right track, in a lot of these later albums, they find a way to do something odd or do something that just doesn't quite work or something that's downright bad that kind of ruins the song or at least distorts your perception of it. If you want to
add to that box since it was your thought.
I think most of the time, again, I even complimented Slayer for the musical composition, the actual, you know, nuts and bolts of the songwriting on Diabolus. And it's basically, you know, there throughout the entire career. There are a couple of points which, for me, I've always said, like, very, very early on, Tom's vocals become unsavory to me. Basically, after Rain and Blood, as soon as the falsettos go away, it's kind of just a, you know, plane heading for the ground for the rest of the records, you know. And there are some moments where they kind of pop in and out. But if you take a great song, like a well-composed track, and you have to sort of manage with Carrie's lyrics, Tom's monotone shouting vocals, and then, you know, the squealy solos, and overlay those as being the classic elements of it in each one of these songs, you kind of find a way to ruin it every single time. I think that's kind of what I was getting at. And we're going to see it in so many instances going forward that, you know, overall, I want to appreciate them, you know, because, again, I think that the songwriting is actually pretty interesting. And I think that, you know, Hanneman, you know, to compliment him, I think that he was primarily the main, you know, music writer in the band. I mean, I know that they shared it early on and they both do solos, but from what my understanding was, is that he was the main riff writer. And if that's untrue, then please correct me.
I'm not sure if it's untrue. I know that he is responsible for writing most of the classic Slayer that we know and love. Most of my favorite Slayer songs were penned musically by Hanneman, at least mostly. And I feel like some of the DNA of these songs definitely has that Slayer vibe to it. Mm-hmm. Like God Hates Disciple, for example, is a fairly classic Slayer riff at times, but it's crushingly heavy in a way that it didn't used to be. And I thought that was interesting. And it's just part of many good ideas that they seemingly exhaust in the first four songs. As Richard said, every time I go back and listen to God Hates Us All, by about song three or four, I'm racking my brain, like, why do I hate this record so much, or at least have a kind of a less than wow opinion of it? And then it all comes crashing home once you pass the threshold, so to speak. I don't hate it as much as Bog does, but because I think it's fun in a kind of brain dead sort of way.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a fun fucking song. It's not great by any stretch, but it's a fun 2.5 minutes of Slayer.
But that is a Diabolus and Musica track that's somehow on God Hates Us All.
Oh, 100%. 100%, for sure. And even though you malign Payback lyric was awfulness, I do agree. I think that's a fun song, too. Like, I just get a chuckle out of it.
Oh, man. Chuckle is not why I come to Slayer, though. Come on. Like, if I wanted to listen to Suicidal Tendencies for a chuckle, like, I would do it, you know? Like,
Payback's a bitch, motherfucker!
I mean, Exile's lyrics are so childish, too. I have them here. Just tell me fucking why everything becomes an issue. Your opinion is always senseless. Fuck this. You make my fucking skin crawl. Like, this is... I mean,
this is someone yelling at their mom at 13 years old because they couldn't go out with their boyfriend.
This is so mallcore, isn't it? I mean, the lyrics of this is just like, you know, 13-year-old Hot Topic, you know?
Yeah. It's not the Slayer I love.
Then Here Comes the Pain. I don't know what the fuck is going on in that song.
Yeah. I will say that
I wish the viewers could see my head. I'm just shaking my head. Like I'm getting angry thinking about it. Like this was a really cool Slayer record that they somehow snatched disappointment from the jaws of a great comeback record.
Can we talk? Yeah, I want to say, you know, you say great comeback record. This album is really pointed at as sort of the great late Slayer record by most people. That's my experience, yeah. And I don't know if y'all would agree with that. Mm-hmm. And so going back and listening to it, and especially seeing what I will say is the quality of the next record, I'm surprised that it still holds up. Because what I said is I think that most people put it on, they listen to Disciple, you know, God Send Death and New Faith, and then they turn it off. And they say, all right, Slayer is back, baby.
You know, I think you're right, because essentially the last three records are, for the most part, ignored, rarely spoken about. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Christ Illusion is great, but the one after that is actually, I think, their best one of all of post-season Slayer, which is World Painted Blood. And then Repentless is just solid. But you're right. For a lot of people, it seems like Slayer's career kind of ends after God Hates Us All. Like, that's just the last one anyone wants to point to. And it's bizarre because there's better material.
Oh, for sure. I mean, honestly, if they put this out as an EP, like just where the intro and up into New Faith, this would have been a great EP. Great Slayer EP. Just that. Bam. Put that out. and then put out an actual really good record with less cringe-ass lyrics. But unfortunately, that's not the timeline we live in. Any more thoughts before we move on from this record, fellas?
I do like the anger that comes through in a lot of these songs. Yeah. And it's the anger that's more anti-religious as opposed to like satanic, like antagonism through Satanism as opposed to just like outright hostility. Sometimes that outright hostility is very fucking goofy. Sometimes it works. On God Hates Us All, or not God Hates Us All, Disciple, it works. On Newfound Faith, it works. Our other songs, it doesn't work. And I feel like it works a lot more on this next record.
Oh, for sure. For sure. All right, so it was around this time that Paul left the band again, and they gave Dave a call back, and they started, they got back to them, they started shows with them, and it was around this time, 2004, they did the Still Raining tour. They essentially did Rain and Blood start to finish. And it was actually up here in Portland, Maine, very close to where I live, about 2.5 hours away, where they did the DVD, filmed the DVD with the famous, you know, they're performing Rain and Blood, and the corn syrup blood shit comes down. So they did that. You know, everyone's, you know, stoked. Oh, you know, Classic Slayer's back. Woo! And then it was on that kind of energy, that, you know, that resurgence at the time that they put out the Christ Illusion in 2006, the first record since Seasons that Dave's back in the band. And I can remember this record came out in high school. I was a really big fan of it. Like, I thought it was a fucking masterpiece. And spinning it now for this has aged as well as I thought. I still think it's a very good record. You know, one of the best of the post-season Slayer, but still quite good, though. What are y'all, some of y'all's thoughts on this album?
All right, so this one's fast. They definitely turn up the speed a little bit initially. You get that right out of the gate, and it definitely doesn't slow down ever into the same levels of grooviness that we've seen for the past, I'll say, two records, but, you know, there's a little bit of it there on Divine Intervention as well. The other thing that I want to mention is that I think that they tuned up on this one as well, maybe to give it a slightly more classic feel, but they're not droning down in the C-sharp territory longer. I think that that really benefits the band a lot, because I think that a lot of, especially with the soloing material, that squealiness kind of needs to be in there. And overall, I just prefer the tone, and I think it could be a symptom of them, you know, making those adjustments that I just spoke about. Lyrically, this album is very much period of when it came out. So, you know, around 2006, we were well into the throes of the War on Terror, as a result of, you had mentioned, 9/11 at that point. So, you know, we were, had troops in Afghanistan. I mean, I think we still do. But this was the start of all that. It was a very raw political climate. And so immediately when you look at the track listing and you have a song called, you know, Jihad, that was absolutely a symptom of what was happening there. And I think it's a little bit regrettable that some of that now feels so specific to that time and that rawness that it hasn't aged as well as potentially like the music and the riffs and all of that has. There's also still a lot of like fucking, you know, screaming inside of the lyrics here. So I think that we're in
not as much,
but it's a little bit of a carry over in the fact that this is a very sort of raw record, and I think that in some ways it was very apt for the time that it came out. For me personally, I think that this is a phenomenal record. I, like Richard, also had a great relationship with this record when it came out. I actually think more highly of it now upon the re-listen, I think, than I did at the time. Now that I've studied some of the riffs a little bit more and take a look at it, you know, immediately following the rest of their catalog that I had just been previously listening to. But overall, I'm quite high on this record. Just to read my standouts, I'm going to say Catalyst. You had mentioned Skeleton Christ early on. I actually think that it's probably one of the most proggy efforts that we see in Slater's later career, with that kind of weird triplet kind of drony riff going in there, and the way that the lyrics are on top of it. And then I really like the second half of it when it picks up and breaks into that riff a lot. we all kind of had a collective chuckle when we looked at Conspiracy, but I actually think that it's a great track.
That song, I do not like the song at all.
Well,
it's not bad. I just personally have never liked it on any level. Like, it's way worse Slayer, obviously, but I've never liked the song personally.
Conspiracy is actually what I would look at to combat Pete's point about jihad being a little bit of a symptom of the time, because reading the lyrics of Conspiracy, he's very much not on board with old George W. And you could actually draw a lot of parallels from like the alt-right to what he's talking about now. Honestly, you could almost say that Kerry King had his little crystal ball. You could apply those lyrics actually today, and they'd be pretty fucking accurate. I would have to look up to see actually who wrote the lyrics to Jihad. It'd be really, you wouldn't have to search very far if it was Tom Araya to wonder why. 1 second.
Another just fantastic track, which I think blends really modern Slayer with some old school vibes, is Cult as well. It has great riffs. It picks up and down. Really, really one of the top standouts on this record that just nobody ever really talks about.
I don't know why. I remember as high school on IFC, Henry Rollins had a show there for a very brief time. Mm-hmm. He had Slayer on there. There's live and studio Cult. It was fucking badass as hell. No, I love Cult. Like, it's top five modern Slayer track, easy.
Okay, so that anti-Iraq war song was Kerry King, Conspiracy. Jihad, which is one of my favorites. And I actually don't think it aged poorly, because I kind of appreciate the fact that outside of dunking on Christianity, they made some room for other problematic religions or elements of problematic elements in said religion, I should say. But Tom Araya, being the Catholic that he is, I think also wrote this song to give his old buddy JC a break from being the punching bag in Slayer. So I also think that these are actually some of the better lyrics too on the record, probably because Tom Araya and Jeff Hanneman wrote them and not Kerry King. It's already been mentioned, Jihad's one of my favorite songs. Cult is another really great song. I'm a big fan of Catalyst and Flesh Storm as well. And despite its clunkiness, both lyrically and musically, I actually dig Conspiracy. And I drew a parallel between Conspiracy and Americon that appears on the next record, World Painted Blood. It's a bit like when Megadeth gets political, it's going to get a little fucking goofy, but sometimes it hits and sometimes it actually has something relevant to say. And I think this is one of those times where it does.
Can we talk a little bit about how unusual the intro riff to Jihad is? I mean, there's just nothing quite like it in the entire catalog up at this point. It's almost, I don't know how to describe it. It's kind of like soft, like almost kind of, I'm sort of grasping here. It's almost kind of U2-ish or something, you know? Like,
very interesting, or good thing you said up to this point, sir, because Slayer likes this riff so much, they straight up rip it off on the next record.
On the next record. I think two songs that have not been mentioned, I'm personally a fan of, is Catatonic. I think it's heavy as fuck.
Dude, the intro is sick. Yeah.
And Black Serenade. I'm personally a big fan of the song. I think it's quite good. And Supremacist isn't bad. I think it's a good closing song. Is that the best
Supremacist
song? Supremacist. Oh, sorry. Supremacist. My bad. But I think it's a good closing track. And I think Flesh Storm is a great opening Slayer song.
If you want to see, just like take a bird's eye view of how big of an improvement this record is of everything else we've talked about on this episode, we just basically listed every track on this record as being cool or having something really fun or awesome about it.
I'm going to jump in here and point out a note. We actually literally just listed every track except for the single Eyes of the Insane was the one that they shot the music video for. We literally named every track except for that one. So it kind of goes to show, like, Slayer is making good music behind the scenes, and it seems like maybe they were able to appease the corporate, you know, commercial dragon a little bit more and put that one out, and then they can, you know, leave the good material still on the table for everybody else who wants to dig into it.
This is also around the time that thrash revolution comes around. Like, thrash gets popular again, starting about 2007, 2008. And I feel like it just now is starting, those waters are starting to recede. Like, it was like around the time I started listening to Revocation, I was like, is thrash popular again? Like, Municipal Waste comes around. Like,
Warbringer.
Yes.
Holocaust, things of that nature. Yeah. The whole retro thrash revival, Fueled by Fire, all those like second tier bands that you never hear much about.
Yes, indeed, sir. So I wonder if this is also why they kind of went back a little bit to their roots, or maybe they just finally realized that that's what they do best. And Satan bless them for it, because demonstrably better results, objectively better results.
Yeah, I'd said it earlier. I'm quite high on this record, actually, and it will express itself in my top 10. But when I went back and listened to it, I said I'm surprised. I would put this up there with, you know, Season After Seasons probably is the next best Slayer record. Wow. So. I want to be a little bit critical of it here, though, to say, I know I said earlier it didn't age well, and I think that one of the things I think is a little bit regrettable is what a blunt object Slayer became later. I think that earlier on they were viewed as being more technical and maybe more savvy because their music was so fast and also kind of edgy at that point. And then once sort of the edge of sort of Satan went away and they started to fill it in with some really good, more socially conscious kind of lyrics and themes, but also just some sort of vague aggression, which is something that I'm critical of a lot of metal bands for being. It doesn't hold up. You know, I wished that this record was just a little bit more finessed lyrically and thematically, and I think that it would potentially be sort of double the record that it really was, because, you know, we all doted upon the music by and large here, and the biggest drawbacks being, you know, a lot of the, again, the fucking fucks and some of the period sort of lyrical themes. So
I was growing up at this time and in my formative years, and I'm struggling. I'm racking my brain outside of like Quentin Tarantino of, I guess, The Sopranos, maybe.
Yeah,
like
definitely
what
The Sopranos
was so fucking popular at the time that HBO programming, I guess, is what we're getting at. Yeah. That popularized just the fuck every other word. That's how you display toughness. Alpha male.
You know, The Osbournes was also on TV, and they just dropped F-bombs every other, you know, all of them, too. So, I mean,
like, Oz, ever the word. Yeah, so it all makes sense.
No, I think we doted on it enough. It's a good record. Good Slayer record. Worthy of being added to a pristine catalog up until 1990.
100%, including Divine, in my humble opinion. But anyways, also, it was around this time that Slayer started the Unholy Alliance tour, so which was a big hit for them. The U.S. version of it, featuring Lamb of God as main support, and then Children of Bodom and Mastodon, and Tom's brother's band, Thine Eyes Bleed, nepotism much, opening all the shows. And then they had the European version, which featured In Flames as main support for some fucking reason, with Children of Bodom and Log and Thin Eyes Lead opening up European run as well.
I will say I remember having this Unholy Alliance 2 Preaching to the Perverted live DVD with Bodom, Lamb of God, Mastodon. There's this really sick live version of Vigil that Lamb of God does on that DVD.
Coming off the high point of Mono Slayer that was Christ Illusion, in 2009 we got World Painted Blood, which production-wise I would say a bit more on the rawer side of things. And I feel a lot of this had to do with the fact they got a guy named Greg Fidelman to do it, who also really shittily produced High and Fire's excellent Snakes for the Divine. Great record. Sounds like ass. Why the songs are phenomenal. And for some reason, Slayer heard this and, dude, we need this guy. He's really accentuates material, World Painted Blood, which it kind of does, I'm not like. So a lot of this stuff's almost kind of like on the punkier side, like Psychopathy Red, Public Display Dismemberment. So it kind of works, but I'm just not a personally fan of the sound on this record. What are some of y'all's thoughts on this record as a whole before I get the individual songs?
Tom Araya's voice is really monotone on this record. And I feel like if Tom Araya's voice was just a little bit stronger on this record, then I would really, really like this record. As is, I still think it's better than even Christ Illusion. I think this is the best of all post-Seasons in the Abyss Slayer, warts and all. I do think they try some really fun things on these songs. It's like Beauty Through Water and Playing with Dolls, especially Tom's vocals notwithstanding. Even the title track, World Painted Blood, starts off kind of, I would say almost goofy when the lyrics like first start kick in, but as the song progresses, it draws you in. It draws you in. I remember being very fucking skeptical about 30 seconds into that song, just kind of giving it the side eye, like, what have they done here? But they really do bring it back in. Americon, I mentioned that previously, is another one of Kerry King's more overtly political tracks, but it's fun. Richard, I think you mentioned The Human Strain. And actually, if there is two songs that could ever hold a hope of being included in the top Slayer lists of all time from postseason Slayer, it's In the Name of God, which is one of my favorite Slayer songs, just kind of period. It's not top 10, probably not even top 15, but top 20. Yes, I think we can definitely make that argument. I kind of really appreciate the militant anti-religious fervor. Hey, that,
even not of this God?
Not of this God? You said In the Name of God. Which
yes, yeah, yes. Sorry. Not of this God. Yes.
Okay, just making sure.
Yeah. Sorry. The scars of that record will remain. Like another abuse victim, just fucking the slips will happen. Not of this God. One of the best Slayer songs of post seasons in the Abyss Slayer. And it's just a good song. Like I said, the almost frantic nature, like Tom's vocal delivery, I think really rams it home. It's just another one of those songs that makes you laugh. Like, man, this guy's a fucking Christian, but he's fucking, he's belting it out here. And considering the frailness of his voice at the time, it's made all the more impressive. And I really like the lyrics on that song.
I'm going to echo what both of the other hosts have said about the production issues. I don't want to labor it too much, but one of the things that really jumped out at me that I liked about it was the electric feel that the leads had. It was this kind of, you know, razor sort of shimmery kind of quality to the effect on them, which is a little bit unusual for Slayer's catalog. So that was something new that they introduced on this record. Something that I didn't like about it was the Injustice for All clicky bass tone. Which, you know, listening to it through, you know, ear pods came off as a little sharp and a little puncturing. I think that it made sort of getting through this album a little bit tougher for me overall. I know that's a very specific gripe. I would say that this continues to bring back a more old school feel to it. I remember I'm kind of with Duel, which is like the beginning of World Painted Blood, you know, starts off a bit slowly, but by the time it really kicks into gear, I'm like, man, we're almost back at Ren and Blood, you know, like, you know, that's as far back as we've gone. I think in some ways that works for and against this record overall, and that this one feels like a little bit more of a pastiche than Christ Illusion. I'm not as big a fan of this one as it, although they're so close. It's like, you know, on you know, which way the wind blows could change my opinion, essentially, sort of what kind of mood that I'm feeling. But overall, I think that this one is a sort of a deeper look back. I like some of the reintroduction of some of the sort of fantasy themes as a move away from some of the more realism and vague aggression that I had talked about on God Hates Us All and Christ Illusion. So in The Human Strain, it's basically about the zombie apocalypse, right? Beauty Through Order is actually about Elizabeth Bathory. Pretty graphic. And actually, I saw an interesting quote from Kerry King, and he said he had wanted to write a song from the perspective of Elizabeth Bathory for a long time, but he was reluctant to do it because he was a man and she's a woman, and he wouldn't know how to write a song from a woman's perspective. So I had to groan a little bit when I said that and was like, all right, let's try, you know, like, it's not going to be that hard, you know. I'll bet you can project and imagine what it might have been like to be her, you know. It's really not that difficult. But
you know, bro, they're another species. Yeah.
But
just say fuck a lot, dude.
Well, but the thing though is, like, that's a fairly, you know, graphic horror film, you know, lyrical content on that track. You know, I'm not gonna quote the most graphic of all the lyrics there about, you know, the sizzling hot knife. But anyways, you should go back and take a look at that one, because it's certainly a more intellectual approach to lyric writing than we had seen for quite some time now. Even on Christ Illusion, you know, I think that they were still sort of riding the wave of, like I said, some of the blunt force fucks that had really apparently worked out for them on earlier records.
Blunt force fucks. I like that. That's a pretty good way of describing it.
I would say another thing, too, that was kind of interesting on this record, I'm talking about the track Snuff, is, you know, a look at contemporary technology. You know, it's about internet porn violence. So, you know, they're trying to stay relevant, and I really commend them for that. And I think that I would say, you know, 90% of the time on this record, they're successful, and other times it feels a little, I don't know, a little try-hardish, but we've certainly seen plenty of that in recent Slayer memory, so I'm not going to lambast them too much for it.
90-10 success rate. They should be taking that all day, considering what has come before this.
I don't think this track's all right. I don't think it's quite as good as Christ Illusion, personally, but there are some standout tracks here. Beauty Through Order, as I've already mentioned. Human Strain. Psychopathy Red is probably one of the most shrillest Tom Araya vocals in a while. Very hardcore punk. I like that a lot. And I think the closing 1-2 punch of Playing with Dolls and Knob of the Scott is fucking brilliant. Great way to close the record out with.
It definitely leaves you with a very strong impression. And I think by the end of World Painted Blood, you're like, okay, I'm on board. And then by the end of the record, you're like, that was fucking sick with those last two songs. I think that really works in the record's favor, even if there's a tad bit of meandering in the middle. But not too bad.
This album ends strong, which is not something that we've seen on a Slayer record in quite some time, I think. The three punch of Psychopathy, Red, Playing with Dolls, and Not of This God as well. So,
yeah. Bam, bam, bam. So it's not how you start, it's how you end, as the saying goes.
Track order is very, very important, and it definitely played to their favor on this time. That was a. That's how you leave them with the good impression, folks. Thumbs way, way up.
Kind of like Game of Thrones. Started off great, but it's how you end. And that's why no one talks about Game of Thrones anymore, because it was fucking pure dog shit. But anyways, enough of my nerdy ramblings. Assuming there's no other thoughts on this record, there's actually a bit of a tumultuous period on the tour for World Paint to Blood, despite the overall quality of the release. First, you had Tom's. Tom began to have issues with his neck. So he was forced to have surgery. He had, to be technical, an anterior cervical discectomy infusion. Essentially, if it had banged too much, if he had continued to, possibly could have been paralyzed. So they had to go. He went into surgery in late 2009, and it solved the issue. But he couldn't headbang anymore for the rest of Slayer's career, which I never had a chance to see Slayer, fortunately, but me being the fan I am, see the classic shit, to me it'd be very weird to see Slayer and not see Tom Araya headbang his ass off.
So Richard, I actually have never seen Slayer either, and I feel the same way that you...
Oh, wow, that's shocking. You're from California. Like, wow, I thought that's shocking. You never caught
them. I'm from Northern California, so I mean, it's like saying somebody from North Carolina had never seen a band from Florida. You know what I mean? Like, you have to think about it like that. But I never saw him because to me, like the later material, it's like they had just depreciated so much. I mean, the fact that I would never see a Tom Araya falsetto was just heartbreaking to me, especially for the prices that I was going to pay to actually get out there and go see him.
You fucked up. I got to see him three times, twice with the original lineup, which was very, very gratifying to see. I got to see them play Seasons in the Abyss from start to finish the first time I saw them.
Cool.
Slayer still hits, even on their farewell show where Tom's voice it's not there anymore. The falsetto, he doesn't even try. When you get them in the big arena shows and like the big Golden Eagle comes down and they set that shit on fire, when they bust out the pentagram with the logo, they also set that shit on fire during Hella Waits. Like, you're reminded just how much why you love this band and how cool they are. I'd compare it a lot to me seeing Metallica a few weeks ago. You can talk so much shit about Metallica, so much, whether about their their offstage douchebaggery that has been well publicized, or just the lack of quality in a lot of their post-Black Album material. But much like Slayer, they don't play the new shit live. You might get one. Like, they played World Painted Blood when I saw them the first time, and Psychopathy Red. I think that was it as far as new songs went. Other than that, it was all of Seasons in the Abyss and then South of Heaven, Angel of Blood, Rain and Death. Rain of Blood, Angel of Death, and South of Heaven, Seasons Rain in the Abyss, and Royal Painted Blood, Psychopathy Red. They ignore that shit. Same thing with Metallica. Metallica might play Fuel, but that's really about it. Other than that, you're getting Creeping Death, Ride the Lightning, Master of Puppets, and the shit people want to hear.
All right, so we had that, which was a big...
I'm sorry, I wanted to check in really quickly, but who is the drummer on World Painted Blood? Is that still Dave?
Still Dave, but shortly thereafter, in 2010, they were going to play the Soundwave Festival in Australia, and they got into a dispute over contracts. Dave felt he was being shafted and wanted the contract be rewritten to favor him more financially. And Slayer said he's going to go fuck himself, and they kicked him out. They brought Paul Deep back, who replaced Bostoff for a short period of the 90s, and then brought Bostoff back again full time for the rest of the band's career. And another note on World Painted Blood was it was the last one with Hahnemann contributing to the record, because it was around early 2011 he unfortunately developed necroticizing fasciitis. My bad, my southern's coming out of me. He was drunk as shit in a buddy's hot tub, got bit by a spider. By accounts of his wife, Catherine, sat around for weeks till she drug him to the hospital, literally. Like, you're going to get this looked at, Jeff. And he had lost a lot of muscle mass and nerve tissue in his arm. And apparently, a couple like months later, they did bring him to the studio to see if he could play. And he just was out of the snuff. On any level of care, it's like, sorry, you know, we can't do this with you. So instead of forcefully trying to improve it better, he was a lifelong alcoholic, and like any alcoholic, drank to dull his sorrows. And around 2010, 2011 as well, you had the big four shows. You know, the big four: American Thrash, Metallica, Slayer, Anthrax, and
Man, they just get dunked on this whole episode.
Megadeth, is that the one you were missing?
Also around, yeah. Also around this time, we had the big four, which American Thrash shows, which they that Metallica, Slayer, Megadeth, Anthrax did in the U.S. They had two in the U.S. and I believe about 10 or so in Europe. And it was at in April 2011, the one in Indio, California, and they brought Jeff out for the last three Slayer songs. That was the last time he performed live with the band. And unfortunately, he did succumb to cirrhosis of the liver, not the spider bite, on May 6, 2013. And I can actually remember when this happened. I had a bottle of wine I had bought, and it's like, oh, fuck, the dude from Slayer died. And like a real metalhead, I chugged the whole fucking bottle of wine. R.I.P. Jeff Hahnemann. Any thoughts about any of that?
Way to chug a bottle of wine for a guy who died from alcoholism.
I know, right? The irony is very present.
Should have been a Heineken, bro.
I didn't have any, or I would have, I can assure you.
I didn't realize that there was sort of internal drama about his ability to perform. I mean, you said that basically the fact that he was being edged out of Slayer because his injury decreased his ability to play guitar contributed to like his excessive drinking. The other thing too is that after listening to Sean Killian from Violence talk about what it was like for him to have liver cirrhosis, like that's a really like painful, awful thing. The fact that Jeff died from that, I guess, you know, over the course of 2 years, I mean, it must have been a really excruciating, agonizing way to go.
Your liver is responsible for a lot, so cirrhosis of the liver fucks you up.
Like, not to get too graphic about it, but there's all kinds of bile buildup and stuff. I mean, I imagine that he must have been having some kind of treatment for that. You know, it's really, I'm thinking about that movie Leaving Las Vegas with Jeff, Nick Cage. I don't know if I was gonna say Jeff Cage. I'm thinking about that movie Leaving Las Vegas with Nicolas Cage. He goes to, you know, he's a screenwriter, failed screenwriter, who goes to Las Vegas and drinks himself to death. And, you know, like that must be kind of what it was like, is he must have been so resigned at that point to his ways. It's really sad. I didn't realize it happened quite like that. You know, people always talk about how metal it was, that it was a spider bite. But really, that wasn't the story at all. It's much more somber than that. So it's too bad. RIP.
Yeah.
It's a bit like on a previous Under the Knife, we talked about the slow decline of Peter Steele. And when you see somebody who used to be such a hulking giant of a man just kind of whittle away until there's really nothing left to lose anymore as far as body mass goes. I mean, it is sad. I think Jeff Hanneman's place in not only Slayer history, but thrash metal history and really metal history is pretty well cemented. I think most people give him the lion's share of the credit for the success of Slayer. Like, people may know Kerry King's face, as he douchily says in Murder in the Front Row. If you're watching this, you know who I am type deal. But I think most of the fan of Slayer
would point more to Jeff Hanneman than they would to anybody else as far as the success of that band is concerned.
Oh, 100%. He wrote all the classic shit, all such a slow, evil, melodic songs. That was all Jeff. And so, another thing that... go ahead, Pete. Before
I wanted to jump in and say that I think it was after... I think it was after Christ Illusion, I saw a quote from Tom saying that they basically sat down and had to discuss whether or not they wanted to continue Slayer. And so they ended up putting out two more records. But that was even back in 2006 or 2007, whenever that was, post after that tour cycle. That was as early as they were thinking about hanging it up. And as you had previously mentioned, Tom's neck issue had certainly become, you know, quite pronounced by, you know, 2008, to the point where he had to go under the knife, in 2009 for that. Do you have any insight, Richard? Did they do this because of contractual obligations? I had speculated off of the air that I wonder if this was them trying to get their sort of financial ducks in order at the end of, you know, a potentially frivolous, you know, career of a rock, you know, living rock stars who toured for most of their adult life. But I don't. You know, no, didn't hear of anything specifically related to that.
In my research for this, I kind of found nothing that would do that. I saw hints of like what you said, but nothing for sure. Like, we decide we're doing two more records, that's it. And honestly, if that was the case, honestly, Christ Illusion would have been a pretty badass, you know, final album. That was going to be, if that was the thought process.
So from what I've gleaned from the Gary King interviews that I've read, is that, as you said, Slayer had discussed hanging it up as far back as 2007. This is from Tom Araya. Tom Araya had been tired of touring and wanted to hang out with his family. Tom Araya was done with being the front man of Slayer for a long time before they actually hung it up. And it was Kerry who essentially dragged the carcass of this band across the finish line, including with that 3-4 year fucking farewell tour. Like, they announced they were breaking up, I think, before even Repentless came out. And then the album came out, and they toured on it for
four years,
essentially. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then Kerry now, still to this day, is saying that we hung it up way too early.
Yeah, I saw the shit. That makes no sense.
And I think, I mean, I don't want to speculate too hard about the character of the man or anything like that, but I think he kind of liked being the de facto leader of the band at that point. And I think he would have been just fine with replacing Tom Araya and just being like, well, I'm the only OG guy left, so kind of what I say goes and it all matters. And he's probably taking the lion's share of the money at that point.
I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about their financial arrangements too, because, I mean, Dave, to me, is such an important member of this band. I really do consider him to be the better drummer between him and Paul, you know, who recorded on it. And I actually got to see him live for the first time playing with Testament just earlier this year. And man, I mean, he is as ridiculous as he is propounded to be. It's his drum kit is like, you know, Geddy Lee status. I mean, it's just insane, you know? So Neil Peart, I'm sorry, I just said Geddy Lee.
Whoa.
Who is the worst guy? Yeah.
He can do keyboard and bass. He can do those drums and he'll be fine.
Whoops. I wanted to jump in here and talk a little bit about the money arrangements, because I really do consider Dave Lombardo to be such an important member of this band. He is certainly pointed at as being sort of the godfather of extreme metal drumming, and in my opinion, the, you know, as I said earlier, better of him and Paul Bostaff to ever show, you know, on recorded Slayer. And two times he left the band due to financial reasons. And so I don't know if that's because they were kind of front loading all of the royalties to, I guess, the, you know, the string parts of that band. But when he left the first time, it was because he wanted some kind of retainer check, essentially, from the label so he could, you know, continue to buy groceries and, you know, pay his rent. And then the second time around, there was, you know, some kind of disagreement or, you know, feelings of unjust between him and the rest of the band about the way that, you know, the way that the band's finances were being structured. So it's always kind of disappointing, what, you know, down the road. The only sort of other thing I can think about is there was some issue with members of Slipknot a while ago, and they talked about how basically, you know, all of that was structured underneath some kind of shell corporation, you know, and that certain members were only employees of the band. They weren't really la 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 la. And so I don't know. It sucks to hear all that, and it you know, certainly contributes to another reason why maybe they wanted to get the hell out of Slayer at this point. But do you know anything about that?
Well, after Dave left the first time, when he was brought back into the band, it's kind of like you said, he was hired on as employee. He was a contractor. He was not an equal member anymore, which I don't know what their personal relationship was at that point, but it's not very good now. They talk about they're not friends. We haven't been friends in a really long time. And so maybe the dudes in that band didn't even feel like bringing Dave back as an evil member. Like, no, he fucked us 10 years ago. So he can come back and we'll make some money for people wanting to see the original lineup. But as far as like you being welcomed back, like nothing ever happened, like fuck that and fuck you.
Dude, that's cold. Actually, that's so cold. Like,
actually at first when they brought him back in 02, Tom and Jeff wanted to carry it, wanted to bring him back in 02 after Paul quit. He didn't want to bring him back at all. So it was actually three times left. So he left briefly in around Rain and Blood, because you know, he couldn't get money. Then after Seasons, he left after Seasons because he wanted time with his family, and then he was denied that. You know, he was said, "Kim, I want to spend time with my family," and they're like, "No, more dates, more touring." So they said, "Fuck y'all." So then Carrie didn't want to bring him back the third time. Where arguably they put out two records, World Paid Blood and Christ Illusion, which beat the fuck out of Divine Intervention as much as I like it, Diabolus and God Hates Us All as far as consistency. Yeah.
You know, Kerry King was only in Megadeth for a few months, but goddamn if he didn't pick up on Mustaine's miserly quality when it comes to penny pinching and your relationships with your band members, dude. It's like, oh, you don't like this? Don't need you on stage or off.
Chuck Schuldiner of Death, and the documentary talks about how they were touring for Symbolic, and they did a Zombie Ritual of Benediction, and like Chuck brought up afterwards, like, how dare you? You weren't supposed to do that. Like, almost like a teacher scolding a student's like type of relationship, like, okay, bro.
I can understand that a little bit more because it has to do with kind of the artistry and the presentation of the band.
Yeah.
When you hear about like some contract nonsense, that's when I start to feel like really sort of just unhappy about it, because it reminds me of like what a horrible industry the music industry really is. Like, just really, really awful from everything I hear. So
it's called the music industry for a reason.
It feels greedy. It starts to feel greedy. A bit like how Bill Ward, they were never able to make it work with Bill Ward. They were never able to make it work for Black Sabbath's farewell tour with Bill Ward, which, you know, was sad, to say the least. Ghost is another really modern example where everybody is a hired gun except Tobias Forge. You're not getting paid on equal level. Slipknot, as Pete already mentioned, is another high-profile one, too.
Deftones, they're the guy that plays She. He just left the band because basically he was a hired gun. He was never a full member. He was getting paid essentially crumbs. So if he put up for like, oh, nearly 10 years, the finally said, fuck it. And he's now doing other shit. But yeah.
That's why I really wonder what Art Cruz is getting paid in Lamb of God.
Well, he just moved to Virginia to be close to his band, like within the past 2 months or so.
So, like, he was with Thy Art Is Murder, so obviously he's making a huge upgrade in money playing with Lamb of God. And everyone's talking about how the band's healthier than it ever been, and like, we're actually friends now, and blah, 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 blah. And I wonder if that extends to the paycheck. Or if they're like, oh, yeah, we're bros, but 10% of what we make.
Testament, Greg Christian, that's why he left the Reformed Testament, was because of that. But then I love Greg, but they did bring back Steve DeGorgio, which is a huge improvement. No offense, Greg, but just saying. So,
which is why in like 5 to 10 years, when Chris Adler inevitably returns to Lamb of God, I wonder if they'll give him also that same deal. Like, you could come back, but you're not one of us anymore.
Hey, Firstborns would be doing great.
Well, I mean, their singer will be dead, so.
All right, so after all that drama and whatnot, also around this time, with Jeff not being in the band, they brought in Pat O'Brien to do some shows in South America and whatnot. And then Gary Holt, of Exodus fame, obviously. Gary Holt then became the full-time guitarist for Slayer. And they went into the studio. Fortunately, not many songwriting credits on the final Slayer record.
I really would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to hear the conversations between Kerry King and Pat O'Brien, a.k.a. Mr. Fucking Florida Man.
Also, who's now in X-Order. He's playing guitar in X-Order. Which, yes, at MDF, I missed it. Like, I was going to Ramshead to see Pro Fanatica, and I skipped it. Like, they were playing. I didn't even notice it. And my buddy Evan's like, I'm on the way back from Deathfest. yeah, Pat O'Brien's a cannibal corpse. He shows you a picture that he took. It's like, well, fuck. Pat O'Brien's a fucking ex-hoarder now. Wow. Completely missed it.
I'm sure he knows he fucked up.
Oh, he did. Like, honestly, say what you want about cannibal corpse, about, you know, how they're boring and whatnot. They are the golden ticket of death metal. As far as merch, tour, resources, everything.
They're the only death metal band outside of Obscura that I've ever seen with a bus. And they have a bus every time. Everyone else is in that white rapist van with the fucking trailer every single time.
Immolation. I love Immolation, but they're always in a van, which is such a shame. Their musical quality is so great, but they never hit that fucking mark that Cannibal did, or you could say Obscura. But enough tangents. So the final record, Repentless, came out also on 9/11. Not luckily, nothing bad happened on this 9/11. So 2015, 9/11, pretty normal fucking day by all accounts. And actually, listening this, me doing this on the knife, was my first time ever listening to this record, because I just remember hearing the single Repentless, like, this is Slayer, whatever. But in hindsight, listen to all their shit. It's actually very good. It's very consistent. Is workmanlike. It doesn't reach the highs, the stage you want the past couple of records, or highs and lows. And that's sudden never has highs or lows. Just kind of, it's there. It's good background metal. It's a respectable final album, but to be honest, there's nothing special about this release.
Yeah, it does have a lot of sort of late career kind of boring, overpicked riffs. You know, it's kind of the symptom of every band trying to come back is some sort of slow. I'm talking about When the Stillness Comes. You know, it's just some kind of picked up and down thing that then builds and builds and builds and builds. You know, Exodus did it on the Atrocity exhibit, Exhibit A. Great record, better than Repentless, but.
Yes, 100%.
It does feel like there's a bit of a formula. We were talking about Exorder a moment ago. They did it recently on, I can't remember the name of whatever their most recent comeback record was that came back.
In the Southern Sky, something like that.
Ablaze in the Southern Sky. So I think that this record, to me, sounds better. I like the tone of all the instruments and everything better than World Painted Blood. It's certainly a more groove-forward record. There are some moments where it sounds downright Pantera-ish. I'm thinking about Chasing Death and an Implode as well. I don't know if maybe that's potentially Gary's influence. I didn't look at the songwriting credits. I will say that the title track feels a little Exodus-ish, and I'm not sure if I'm just reaching for that because I'm such a big Exodus fan.
Yes.
All right, well.
No, I there's a noticeable difference in songwriting. Like, it's very... It's very the consistency just blew my mind, because so much of that story is up, down, up, down, up. This one's consistent. It's, I would say, almost on the level of the early records. Not so much in quality, but the consistently was a very nice change up by comparison to the past few.
It's so consistently meh and forgettable that instead of thinking about Relentless when we were talking about it, I was thinking of Pete saying Ablaze in the Southern Sky and imagining album art of a meth lab exploding in Florida. And I don't want anybody to steal that from me. But if you do, I want credit.
With a Confederate flag flying in the back.
Oh, man.
Pat O'Brien. Pat O'Brien's also on the cover, naked.
Oh, my God.
Funny story. Alan West of Obituary, he was caught in early 2000s with a meth lab, but he was methed out for like a week. He thought people after. He called the cops, ran to the woods. Cops come to the house, find his meth lab. He's like, oh, well, about the meth lab. He's let me see what had happened was. Putting aside, but yeah, this record is, again, working like its job done. It's a respectable final album, but to me, I couldn't really stand out. Piano Wire was the last song Jeff contributed to.
You said that was the dude from Obituary?
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Alan West.
Okay, so Pat O'Brien from Cannibal Corpse tries to suicide by cop. The dude from Obituary has a meth lab. Trey Acetone from Morbid Angel's like, don't worry, officer, I'm a professional drinker. Chuck Schuldiner kills himself after a tumultuous career, shall we say, interpersonally. Like, I don't know what is up with Florida men and death metal, but there is something in the water down there, dude.
100%.
Oh, man.
I don't really think we have much there. This record, I have no standouts on the south.
What I was going to say is what's in the water is all the leftover medication from all the dead old people. They just flush it down the toilet. It makes its way back into the municipal water supply, and everybody's just fucked up and crazy.
The municipal waste, if you will.
Talk about the record. I have a note here that the intro riff to Atrocity Vendor is almost like pop punk. Like, it's kind of just like a little bouncy.
Like a water?
Yeah, a little.
Which I saw that song performed live. Honestly, the song's really good live. When I saw the Maryland Death Fest opening pre-fest, this song translates very well live. I'll give you one of that. I like the song live a lot.
I mean, it's a really appropriate song title, Atrocity Vendor, considering the title and how forgettable it is. I wouldn't quite call it atrocious, but...
This feels like a stock record. I think that it felt more symbolic or ceremonial than it did like a real artistic effort. You know, they had announced that they were going out. They had to put out one last one so they could tour for it endlessly. And as soon as Richard gets back to the microphone, I'll let him sort of take us out on that note. But like I said, this does feel like I said, it does feel like a gesture rather than... And you know, maybe that's a bit harsh because, you know, there's some fun stuff on here. I do like the title track. You know, like I said, Chasing Death is, you know, kind of a groovy, you know, fun track. You called it background metal, Richard. This one does feel so much less compelling than even the previous two. And I'm having a hard time articulating why. In some ways, it's maybe because there is no, like, production flaws for me to nitpick at that, you know, it just feels like it kind of just... I don't know. It feels maybe not overproduced, but, you know, a little bit engineered, if that makes sense, or contrived.
I think the word you use, stock, is actually a pretty accurate one. If there could be stock footage of Slayer, like, we need a Slayer riff, guys, shit one out, it would be this record. And I think it's kind of like that the whole way through. Like, even the songs that I like, When the Stillness Comes and Repentless, I would never... If I wasn't doing it for this podcast, I would have never gone back and listened to this record. And now that I've heard it three more times for this podcast, I don't think I'll ever go back and listen to this record. Like, there's no point. There's nothing stand out in a good or bad way. Like, it's not for the lulls and it's not for the quality. There's literally just so much better Slayer, both in quality and quantity. Like, so much better Slayer that... Outside, if they weren't breaking up, I would struggle to come up with a reason why it exists or why it even should exist.
I'll write a list of Undisputed Attitude. Yeah, I fucking said it. Call me crazy. At least that album's kind of interesting. But yeah, alright. So they put out Repentless, the final record. And then they did five farewell tours across North America and Europe, with such bands as, of course, Lamb of God, Napalm Death, Behemoth, Amon Amarth, Primus for some fucking reason.
Cannibal Corpse.
Obituary, we'll get to them. Phil Anselmo performing Vulgar Display of Power songs, Anthrax, Testament, and the aforementioned Cannibal Corpse that my co-host Pete Duell just mentioned.
Yeah, when I saw them... It was Napalm Death, Testament, Anthrax, Lamb of God, and Slayer.
That's a very diverse lineup, I gotta say. Pretty interesting.
Napalm Death is the outlier there. Like, that one is like, what? Like,
100%.
I was pissed because I think we were the first date with Napalm Death, and it was Behemoth, the shows before.
That's a fucking downgrade. Even I would take the worst new Behemoth material to any classic Napalm as well, if I'm being honest. Fuck Napalm Death. Anyways.
And you best believe, I think it was in 2017, 2018, Barney was on that Trump train.
Oh, God. Yeah. It was Abnormality, Power Trip, Napalm, and Black. And between literally every fucking song, President Donald J. Trump, shut the fuck up. Jesus. Oh, it's obnoxious as fuck. More obnoxious than Trump himself. Trump was an obnoxious cunt too, but Barney was more obnoxious, caused to bring the motherfucker up between every goddamn song. Shit.
Oh, man.
Anyways.
Longer than some of the Napalm Death songs they played.
And they played like fucking 30 goddamn songs over the course like 70 fucking minutes. Like, it was terrible. Fuck Napalm Death. That's the
point. Oh, man.
Little rant here.
It's so funny. It's like a meme. They were like, this next song is You Suffer. And everyone's like, yeah. And then like they eventually fart into the mic and was like, hope you liked it.
Yeah, it's like Suffer. It's like 4 seconds. So.
Two.
Yeah. Rants aside. So Slayer did 5 fucking farewell tours. North America, Europe. The final 2 shows were at the Forum in California, November 29th and November 30th. Unsurprisingly, Lombardo was not in attendance of either. He claimed he was working on the other musical projects. Which had been burned twice by the band, I can't really blame him. And with that being said, that's pretty much the end of Slayer, though, as Duel has mentioned, Carrie's mentioned how they retired too early, and Tom's fucking done. And, I mean,
I remember there being intense rumors that Carrie and Phil Anselmo were going to form this super group that essentially was just going to play Slayer and Pantera songs, and it would have fucking sold. I mean,
oh yeah, 100%.
Like people would pack that show out. Like,
did y'all remember the rumor how Pantera's reunite with Zakk Wylde on guitar instead of Dimebag? This has been going on for like 10 fucking years. That fucking rumor.
I assume that one day it's going to happen. I thought that when Phil was testing the waters, doing a vulgar display of power with his Phil Anselmo and the Illegals band, and now that Vinny and his wife are both dead, I believe, like, there's very few members of Pantera who can stop him now.
Rex isn't going to protest, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I'm actually surprised it hasn't happened yet, but credit to him for not just beating that horse as soon as he got the opportunity to do so.
We're going to do our top 10. So I'm a real dickhead and put mine first, and y'all can do yours, whatever order you decide to choose. I have 12 in totality. One moment.
I like how we've all settled into like our own sort of modes for honorable mentions. I always have one. Richard, you seem to have 2 most of the time, and Duel just has like a second list of honorable mentions.
Five million, and here's the top 10.
Duel's like, I'm just going to shout out good tracks for like about a minute, and then I'm going to get into my top 10 here.
All right.
His top 10 lists are hard, sir. The critical ear. These things demand attention.
I can say for sure this is the easiest top 10, especially compared to the classic Slayer, that I've been involved in quite a while. So for my honorable mentions, my 2, I have Playing with Dolls and Human Strain from World Painted Blood. Going into the top 10, coming at number 10, I have New Faith off God Hates Us All. Number 9, I have Ditto Head off of Divine Intervention. Number 8... the title track, Divine Intervention, off Divine Intervention. Number 7, I have Catatonic off Christ Illusion. Number 6, Fictional Reality off Divine Intervention. I think you notice a theme here. Going into the top 5, the only worthy song off this album, In the Name of God off Diabolixi Musica. I've always kind of loved this song. This record just... especially the record in totality is how what a great song is, how high and above it stands beyond every other fucking song off that release. Number 4, Jihad off Christ Illusion. Number 3, Cult off of Christ Illusion. Number 2, Disciple off God Hates Us All. Fucking a phenomenal Slayer track. And number 1, 213. Off of Divine Intervention, my personal favorite modern Slayer, post-season the Abyss of Slayer. Whoever wants to take the floor, you are more than welcome to it.
So since you fuckers were talking shit about how much honorable mentions I like the stuff in there, I'm going to stay true to the brand. However, unlike Richard, I refuse to list 10 good Slayer songs from this era, mostly out of protest. There probably is 10 good ones, but I struggle to call it a top 10. That's why I had to combine the top songs and the honorable mentions. But you can't have 2 sets of post-90s or post-season Slayer without the shit ones. And so, for a band so closely aligned with Satan, instead of giving you a top 10 with some honorable mentions, I went with a 666 method. Six goods, six honorable mentions, and six flaming pieces of dog shit.
I don't know about this. Richard, do we want to veto this? I don't know if you just get to change the format here, Joel.
Well, unfortunately, I just did, sir. So starting at number six, let me go first.
Let me go first because I have a top 10. And
if we're doing that, do that. This is due. I'm interested. I do want to hear it. But let's do the normal and then shake it up with something new.
But now I got to redo the intro.
You can edit this. You're going to edit this. So just grab all that and move it.
Yeah. Boop, boop, boop,
boop, boop, boop. Look, I don't really care. I'm sorry. If you feel like I'm totally destroying that, but you know All right, I'll just get in here. I'm going to be fast. I only got one honorable mention. It is Repentless, the title track off of the last record, Repentless. Coming in at number 10, I have The Human Strain off of World Painted Blood. Number 9, I have Jihad off of Christ Illusion. Number 8, Psychopathy Red. Psychopathy Red off of World Painted Blood. Coming in at number 7, I have Catatonic from Christ Illusion. Following it up, I have number 6, Catalyst, also off of Christ Illusion. I know that there was a little bit of a head shake on that one when I shouted it out earlier, but I will say that it is a pretty fun return to form.
I like the leads in the chorus part a lot. Overall, I think it sounds bad, but I like the chorus guitar parts.
All right, coming in at number 5, I have Beauty Through Order, the Elizabeth Bathory track. It's actually, I'd mentioned it as being a favorite, but it's also a little bit of a sort of more interesting riff writing, sort of, I'm going to call it proggy track, and you know, sort of a more heady fantasy based lyrical theme, which after a lot of the blunt force stuff from earlier on was a nice gasp for air. Coming in at number 4, cringy ass title but great song, I have Conspiracy off of Christ Illusion. So this is sort of one of the most political moments that I think Slayer ever really gets. Coming in at number 3, this one's probably gonna solicit another groan from Mr. Richard Donahue here, I have Skeleton Christ. I really love the I don't think that Tom's vocals are the best ever, although when have they have been since Rain and Blood, but and the lyrics are not fantastic, but I do love this track compositionally and musically, and that sort of triplet riff is just a little bit of a standout in Slayer's catalog overall. Coming in at number 2, I have Disciple off of God Hates Us All. That riff is a sledgehammer, and you know, like I said, pretty much everybody thought that Slayer was back after they heard it and then turned off their CD players.
Have a track 4.
Coming in at number 1, I have Cult off of Christ Illusion. This is by far my favorite, basically post-seasons song. I have 6 out of 10 from Christ Illusion. I'm a big fan of that record if y'all couldn't figure it out. So go and give that shit a listen. So, Duel, let's hit us with your 666 format list here.
So, we actually have a lot of songs in common. So, starting off with the good ones, our honorable mentions, we'll say I have God Send Death at number 6. Coming at number 5, In the Name of God. Also, Fictional Reality at number 4.
Yes.
Catalyst at 3. 213 at number 2. And the one that almost cracked the top 6 but didn't quite make it, Psychopathy Red from World Painted Blood. Now, you talked about how Christ Illusion heavily dominated your top tracks. Mine's kind of a little bit more dominated by World Painted Blood. Coming in at number 6 of the actual good songs that I really like that our timeless Slayer, regardless of era. I got Jihad at number 6, Beauty Through Order at 5, Cult from Christ Illusion at 4, Playing With Dolls coming in at number 3. Also, matching your placement, Bogger Bitch, I have Disciple from God Hates Us All coming in at number 2.
All three of us have that.
And coming in at number 1 is, you probably could have guessed the way I gushed over it earlier, Not of This God, the final track off World Painted Blood. I think that's just a damn good Slayer song, regardless. And to make this fun, and because there were so many verbal shit barbs thrown this episode, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind you all of the atrocities against good taste that we had to endure listening to this. So here they are, the 6 shittiest pieces of recording that Slayer has ever produced. Coming in at number 6, the entire Undisputed Attitude album. Seriously, what the fuck?
The whole record, not a moment. It's all dog shit. Throw it out.
Including Gemini. Have you heard that shit?
What do you mean including Gemini? I know you have. Especially Gemini.
Coming in at number 5, we've talked about it, laughed about it. Payback. Oh, just what the fuck is that?
I don't know who wrote this. Payback's a fish, motherfucker.
Yeah.
getting through it was a bitch, let me tell you. Number four, Here Comes the Pain. As I said earlier, the pain had been there long before that track arrived, and it remained long after. Number two, I have number three, I have Stain of Mind. Obviously, yeah. We talked about it earlier. Just absolute cringe bullshit.
Dog shit, dude.
Number two, I didn't really talk about it just because I wanted to save it for this, but for some reason, it particularly stuck in my crawl. Death's Head. Fuck that song. Fuck that record. And number one, yeah. Love to Hate. I love to hate every one of these songs in this list. It's shit. Irredeemable. I wouldn't even listen to them as a joke. If they were released today, you would assume the band was trolling you. And maybe they were. Anyway, that is my 666 format. It probably will not be revisited again, but given the huge gulf in quality between records and even songs on the same record, I thought it was the more appropriate way to express my ranking of these songs from post-Slayer, or post-Seasons of the Abyss era Slayer.
I'd like to thank everyone for listening to my part two, the not arguably shittier part of their career, but if there's any takeaway I would feel from this, I would definitely highly suggest giving Divine Intervention, Christ Illusion, and World Pain and Blood a second listen if you have not, because there are real treasures in those albums.
I would highly recommend you reset all that without hitting the table. Please.
All right. Clean edit. Well, thank you all for listening to my second part of part two of Slayer of the Knife. I know this is a much shittier side of Slayer, but if you take anything away from this, I would highly recommend giving Divine Intervention, Christ Illusion, World Pain of Blood a second listen, because there's some true gems in those records. As well as other records, but they're easier to spot because they're a lot fucking crappier. They should be honest with themselves.
As Richard said, thank you all very much for listening to the Fundamentalist Podcast presents Under the Knife, Slayer Part 2. If you dug what you heard, then go back and listen to previous episodes. They're all in the same spot after all. And we will catch you all next time. My name's Dual Guest.
I'm Peter Bogg.
I'm Richard Donahue.
And until next time, goodbye.